And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We broadcast from UC Irvine campus. We stream live on KUCI.org. Today's Wednesday, September 26, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelist Todd Goldberg and literary agent Jenny Dunham. First up is Todd Goldberg. Todd is the New York Times bestselling author of more than a dozen novels and story collections, including most recently Gangster Nation, a sequel to the international bestseller and Hammett Prize finalist Gangsterland, both from Counterpoint Press. The House of Secrets, which he co-wrote with Brad Meltzer, and Living Dead Girl, finalist for the Los Angeles Times Book Prize. Formerly a book critic and columnist for a number of newspapers in Las Vegas, Todd earned 5 Nevada Press Association Awards for Excellence and, in 2016, was honored with the Silver Pen Award from the Nevada Writers Hall of Fame in recognition for his continued excellence in the field. Todd founded and directs the Low Residency MFA program in creative writing for the performing arts at the University of California, Riverside. And he's here primarily to talk about Gangsterland and Gangster Nation. Today, here he is, Todd Goldberg. Hello.
I am actually prepared to talk about anything that you want to talk about,
all
Barbara.
Right. All right.
We can talk frozen treats. We can talk American politics. We can talk about the Oakland A's. We can talk whatever you want.
Well, you know, that leads into something I was going to talk to you about much later, which is that you have quite a social media presence. You're on Facebook. You're on Instagram. You're all over the place. And what I notice is that you're always yourself. I mean, you don't have a persona. You're not the serious guy in social media and then, you know, a crazy guy all the other time. You're just yourself, which I think is just wonderful because sometimes it's hard to know who people are, right, on social media.
Of course.
So talk about that. I mean, you run this program. You have these books. I mean, have you always just been yourself?
Well, I hope so. I think a lot of it comes from the fact that I come from a family of writers. And so, like, my mom was a society columnist. And wherever she was, it didn't matter if she was at home or if she was at some fabulous party or if she was shopping at Safeway, she was always the society columnist. So she was always wearing, you know, like a Bob Mackie dress and a Chanel number 5 and smoking. And my dad was a TV newsman, so he always talked in that voice. And I didn't necessarily want to be like them, but I knew that who I was who I wanted to be, and that I wasn't scared to be that and to be expressive of my thoughts and of my opinions. And particularly, you know, in this sort of day and age, whatever platform that you might have as a writer or as a person within culture, I feel like it is your job to speak up about whatever it is you're going to speak up about while you still can.
Yeah, so you're not one. Well, this is the thing. I mean, because you run a program, you have students, you, I guess, have to appeal to, I don't know, everyone.
Right.
Then, you know, sometimes being opinionated or outspoken alienates people. And,
sure.
You don't really seem to have that problem.
Well, I'm sure that I rub people the wrong way. Some people, I mean, for sure. Like, at some point, someone was sitting in their home right now, and they're like, Todd Goldberg, oh, God, what's on K-Rock? You know, so I'm sure that that's happening. But, you know, I feel like what you see with me is largely what you get. Now, of course, when I'm at home, I'm more quiet, and I'm mostly just sort of sitting around eating Nutella and worrying about things. But, you know, as a professor, and particularly running a very large MFA program, you know, we have 100 students in the program. We've been around for 10 years. You know, what I espouse on that side is that my job is to get you to the point to become a professional writer. And as a professional writer, you can choose to be out in the world or you can choose to be quietly at home. I've chosen to be out in the world, and it hasn't affected me as a writer. I'm still able to do all the things that I want to do. But I'm always pushing my students to write for publication and to understand the business that is involved in it. And I think that above anything else is the thing that attracts students to the program is we get our students published. And I think that's what students want these days. I hope it's what they want. Or else I'm sending out a lot of people to become successful writers and they could be baristas.
Well, what about social media? I mean, do you think it's a good thing for writers or is it a time suck for writers?
Oh, it's a terrible thing for writers. You know what it's good for, Barbara? It's good for talking to your writer friends in the middle of the afternoon and making you feel less alone with your procrastination. I don't know. I mean, for many years, I wrote a weekly column in a newspaper in Las Vegas where it was just me, you know, getting into stupid situations in the world, just my basic life of going to Trader Joe's and saying the wrong thing to the wrong person. And I feel like Twitter or Facebook is an extension of that, where I'm just talking about my life, and it just so happens I'm talking about it with other writers frequently. But, for me, the best part is I live in Palm Springs. The majority of my friends live in Los Angeles. But every day I can get onto Twitter and David Ulan and I can argue with people. And that makes me feel very happy.
Oh, that's funny. Well, speaking of TJ, see, I remember some of your posts and one of them was, put the cart back.
Yeah, I'm a believer that basic society will crumble the day the last person decides, you know what, I'm just going to leave that there. I'm not going to take it back.
Oh, that's funny.
I'm a man who takes the cart back. I'm also a man who wipes off my cart when I'm done using it. Which
after.
Might just mean I'm monk, but I do it.
That is funny. I've not thought to wipe it off after, but that's a very considerate
idea. I'm a kind
idea.
Man, Barbara.
Yeah. I guess so. Well, speaking of this, the work you did in Las Vegas or the journalism that you've done, you started out as a journalist?
No, not really. I started off as a short story writer. Well, my first job, actually, out of college, I got people temporary jobs for a living, which is a terrible job for someone who couldn't get a job. Like, I was rejected from every job, and so I went to a temp service, and I'm like, you aren't right for any of the temp jobs that we have, but would you like to be in charge? So for a year and a half, I did that. And then I worked in the infomercial business for another year and a half, and that was terrible. And then mostly I was just writing short fiction. And I really didn't start to become a journalist until after my first book sold. And after my first book sold, which was, and you're going to talk to my agent, so she can tell you about it. But after my first book sold in 1998, and then it came out in 2000, I got offered a job. I'm writing for the newspaper in Las Vegas, writing this weekly column. And that sort of morphed into, a pretty long career as a columnist. And then primarily, and I still do a bit of it, of book criticism. I still write a lot of essays and articles and things like that in my spare time. But there was a period of time when I was, after my first book had come out, where I was a freelance writer for a bunch of different magazines. And so I was inexplicably the food critic for Palm Springs Life magazine and the nutrition expert at Better Nutrition magazine.
That's great.
Now, I might sound like an extraordinarily physically fit person to those of you in the radio in your cars right now. I am your average 5'10" Jewish person. I could lose a little. I mean, I'm fine, but I could lose a little. And so the mere idea that I was writing these super long pieces on nutrition was just absurd, but I was doing it. And then one of these pieces that I wrote for Better Nutrition magazine has been taught for years and years and years as this sort of template of, you know, where organic farming came from. And so every couple months I get a check for my reprinted article from Better Nutrition magazine. So I did everything. But, the point at which I really stopped doing freelance articles, I was writing for Palm Springs Life magazine here in the desert. And I had been asked if I would write an article on new technologies in golf. And I was like, yeah, that seems fine. I'll do that. And the article is going to be 650 words, and I had to go interview people in the sprinkler industry. And like every day that I would sit down to write this article about new technologies in golf, I'd think, so this is it? This is what it's come to? I'm literally writing about sprinklers? And my lovely wife, who's also a writer, she was like, you don't need to do that stuff anymore. And I was like, I don't? She's like, no, we do fine now. I was like, oh, well, I'm going to stop worrying about sprinklers. And that was a very freeing moment.
Well, talk about, though, the crossover from fiction to journalism and back to fiction. I mean, I haven't read your articles on farming or nutrition or any of that yet. I'm going to, but was your voice the same? Is your voice the same, or do you go into a different mode?
Oh, I go into a different mode for that sort of thing, because you had to. You know, it was magazine style for a particular magazine, so all the articles sounded pretty much the same. But when I write essays or book criticism, I think it's a slightly different voice. So I had a piece that just came out last week about my great love of gangster fiction, which I write, and then gangster rap music, which I sort of came up on and which affected me as a writer. And it's a long, 3,000-word essay that's in Crime Reads. And I think if you read that, you can tell that it's written by the same person who wrote Gangster Land and Gangster Nation, but it's a more personal thing, and I'm talking about myself and my own thoughts and not about a character. But I think I view the world in a skewed way. And so when I'm writing nonfiction, critical work or essays, my voice comes out. If I'm reviewing the latest technology in Rainbird, all that's coming out is my willful desire to leave this planet.
Oh, man, that's great, though. Your voice is so apparent from the first line of Gangster Nation and Gangsterland and all your fiction, actually. And so let's just talk about that for a little bit. Your protagonist is a gangster turned rabbi. And I am curious how you decided to have Sal impersonate a rabbi.
Well, wow, it's a slightly long story, but I'll shorten for you. So the genesis of these books is actually a short story that I wrote in 2008 called Mitzvah, which was in Las Vegas Noir. And you, of course, are familiar with the Noir mm-hmm. series because you've written in them as well. It's a series of books put out by Akashic Press. And I had been assigned to write about the neighborhood in Las Vegas called Summerlin, which, if you're not familiar with it, is... it's the Orange County of Las Vegas, but it's still Las Vegas, so it's still gross. and they had paid me, and I hadn't written anything. And I was here in Palm Springs, and I was down the street from the airport picking somebody up from the airport, and there's a very old Native American cemetery just by the airport. And I'd seen it my entire life living here, but I'd never seen anybody walk out of it because it's a cemetery. There's not a lot of... Not a lot of walking out of it, I guess. And all of a sudden, the gates opened and a person walked out of the cemetery. And I thought, if you really wanted to commit a perfect crime, and this is a thought that I have frequently, if you really wanted to commit a perfect crime, what you do is you'd kill someone and bury them in an old cemetery because no one's digging up old caskets in an old Native American cemetery. And then, as my mind often does, I thought, well, how could you make money from that? And then I thought, well, maybe the mob owns this cemetery. And I was like, well, then you'd need to get a priest. I don't know anything about priests. Oh, but I do know about rabbis. And so in the course of, a red light, all of a sudden I had this rabbi that was working for the mafia, burying mafia dead in a Jewish cemetery. And then I just had to work backwards and figure out how this rabbi got involved, and it ended up being that I created this hitman who is on the run after killing the wrong people in Chicago, and essentially he gets sold to another crime family who give him a bunch of plastic surgery and turn him into a rabbi. The problem for me as a writer and as a Jew is I really didn't know much about being a rabbi because I'm a terrible... mayonnaise on a corned beef sandwich Jew. Like, I'm not a great Jewish person. Like, I like Neil Diamond, I like Barbra Streisand, I like the Beastie Boys, I like the idea of 8 Days of Gifts, but I'm obviously Jewish, but not religiously so. And so, after I wrote that short story, I knew I wanted to write books about this character, and so I had to do all the studying. And so, over the course of the last many years, I've been writing about this character. I've read all the holy books. I've read all the books that Rabbi Cohen would read. And it's been a real spiritual awakening for me. I don't think I'm any more religious from it, but I think I'm far more spiritual. I think I'm far more Jewish than I've ever been in my life in the process.
Hmm. That's so interesting. So you all are listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm with Todd Goldberg, and his most recent books are Gangsterland and Gangster Nation. So that's really interesting. So the story sort of generated the novel, the first novel. And when you wrote the story, did you have any inkling that it would become something more?
As soon as I finished the short story, I thought, oh, there's something more here. And then I showed it to my friend, the writer Gina Frangello, who at the time was my editor for a short story collection called Other Resort Cities that came out in 2009. And she read the story, and she said, she's from Chicago, so she's got a Chicago voice. She said, Todd, you've got to write that as a book. And she's also apparently Marge Simpson. And I was like, yeah, I feel like I do need to write this as a book. I feel like there's something larger here. And then I got very lucky in that even from that short story, I sold the TV rights to the short story, which is something that's actually happened time and again for these characters. So right now the books and the stories are all owned by the people who make the TV show Peaky Blinders. Mm-hmm. Now, whether or not anything ever happens, you know, who knows? But even from the short story, I knew that there was Hollywood interest in it. And so I knew I was going to write the books. What I didn't realize is that I was going to end up writing a trilogy, and then leaving it always open for the prequels and, you know, putting a dragon in it or, you know, maybe a magic boy with a lightning bolt. I'm working on what I'm viewing as the third and final book in the trilogy right now. But everyone that's involved that isn't writing the actual book, so my agents, my editors, the folks in Hollywood, they all tell me the same thing, which is, you know, don't slam the door on this character.
Yeah, don't kill him.
Don't kill him. So we'll see what happens. I mean, we'll know in summer of 2020 when the book comes out.
Well, you know, talk a little bit about that, about creating villains or antagonists that do very bad things, and yet we like them and want to see them continue. I recall you saying, I think it was at Sisters in Crime a couple of months ago when you came to talk about Gangster Nation. I think, yes, that's mm-hmm. what you were talking about primarily. You said something to the effect of the way to make a good villain is to make him loved by someone.
Right. And I think that's true. You know, there's no reason, for instance, at the end of The Silence of the Lambs, when Hannibal Lecter hangs up the phone with Clarice and announces he's going to eat the doctor that had been his captor in the prison. Mm-hmm. And everyone in the audience at that point, I just saw the movie with a bunch of people, and everyone cheers, oh, he's going to go eat that doctor. That all that doctor has done has been have a large ego and been slightly rude to a cannibal. But by the end of that movie, you're like, yes, he should be eaten alive. Because at that point in the movie, but also in the book, and the ending of the book is a little bit different, but at the ending, either way, you have grown attracted to Hannibal Lecter because Clarice has grown attracted to him, not in a sexual way, but in an intellectual way. There is an appreciation amongst both of them for who they are, and empathy for one another. And Hannibal Lecter's charming. You want to be near him. He's funny. He's interesting. He's weird. And so when I have been writing this character of the Rabbi David Cohen, who's actually the hitman Sal Cupertine, I made his driving force being his desire to get back to his wife and child. And I've also put in the point of view of his wife and child into the book as well. And I think what that does in a way is it humanizes him, because if someone can love him and he can love someone else, then that gives you the idea that he can change, and that he is capable of being a human being. Now, that's not always true, because I watch all of those, you know, shows in the middle of the night also, where it's, you know, John Wayne Gacy seemed perfectly normal in his clown suit. Like, no, he did not seem normal in his clown suit. You know, we know killers can compartmentalize. That happens a lot. But when you're reading a book about them, if that person, if this person who's naturally a villain, is the person who also is writing chaos, if they are the better person in the room surrounded by everybody else, you're going to root for that person. And so I always try to draw not good guys or bad guys, but complex characters, people that are shades of gray. Because you don't want a Bond villain, you know, petting a white cat and saying, "I will get you, Mr. Bond, if I don't get $50 billion. Like, you know, those are the books I grew up reading, and even then I was like, why does he have a cat? Like, who feeds the cat? Like, I always have these questions, like, who's washing the cat? Who gets the Mr. Friskies for the cat? which probably made me an annoying 9-year-old, right? Like watching, Moonraker and being like, how do they get to the moon? Really? Come on. Why do they have a cat on the moon? Why is that Jaws guy have such terrible teeth? So anyway, I'm always trying to draw these characters with a complexity that makes them curious to the reader, and even when they do objectionable things, make sure that those objectionable things weigh on that character. So in Gangster Nation, I won't spoil this, but at one point in the book, Rabbi Cohen kills the wrong person, and it haunts him for the rest of the book, and then it's haunting him through Death of a Gangster, also the book that I'm writing right now, because there are rules of engagement in this game, and he broke one of them.
Well, you know, Todd, we should have arranged for you to be on for the entire hour, because I have like at least a dozen more questions.
So, I'm happy to stay. If you like, you can bump my literary agent.
Can I get you to come back sometime in the near future?
Of course.
Okay. Todd, thank you so much for taking the time, and I'll be in touch about getting you back on in the next couple of months.
I would love to be back, and thank you also for what you do. It's a great show, and that you've been doing it for so long is a testament to the worth of it. So don't stop,
okay,
as the Beastie Boys once said.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
That was Todd Goldberg. His books are Gangster Nation, Gangsterland, many others. He has a story in Las Vegas Noir. He's all over the place, and he has a podcast that I wanted to talk about. It's easily found. If you need to find it and can't, email me at penonfire@earthlink.net, and I'll give it to you. You can find out other things at penonfire.com. That's all we have at the moment, but we're going to be back in the next half with Todd Goldberg's agent, Jenny Dunham. So please don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Just the mention of your name turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby, I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through, deep in my heart I know I've lied. I've lied. I've lied. I'd get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you, my love, my whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 I can't, oh, I can't, oh, I can't forget you. My whole world turns misty blue. Oh, 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 my love. My whole world turns misty blue. Baby, 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 I can't forget you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the UC Irvine campus, streaming live at kuci.org. Another way you can listen to the show is by going to iTunes, searching out podcasts, Writers on Writing, and subscribing. And every time we upload a new show, you will find it in your podcast folder, wherever that is, probably on your phone, maybe on your computer, and you can listen to the most recent show, and you'll also be able to access the feed for past shows. So please do that, and if you're so moved, leave us a review on iTunes. That would be great, too, because that'll help others find the show. I guess it raises its accessibility, visibility, something like that. In any case, I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I spent the first half hour with novelist Todd Goldberg, and now I am back with his agent, Jenny Donham. Jenny has been a literary agent in New York since May 1992. In August 2000, she founded Dunham Literary, Inc. She represents literary fiction and nonfiction for adults and children. She's been a member of the Association of Authors Representatives since 1993. She graduated from Princeton with a degree in anthropology and has a master's degree in social work from NYU, although she only practices with characters on the page. Hi, Jenny.
Hi.
You know, tell me how an anthropology major with a master's in social work became an agent.
Well, so first of all, the social work master's came much later. So in the beginning, I started out as an anthropology major, someone interested in people and different cultures and different ways of living and different challenges of being alive and being human. And storytelling, ethnography is a big part of anthropology, and it's about how the stories that people tell and the ways that they make meaning in their lives. And books had always been very important to me, so I just took that under my arm, almost as if it were a package, and went looking for the right career. And this was a really good fit.
That's interesting. I know quite a few philosophy majors who became agents. So it's just sort of interesting coming at it from something other than, say, you know, English literature or creative writing or, you know, editing. Yeah, really interesting. So, and I would think also that a background in social work would help you deal with writers and others in the tumultuous field of publishing.
It does. It's been good in many ways, both on and off the page. Having those skills of conflict negotiation and deep listening and to what people want and how to help them get more of what they want and less of what they don't. And looking at characters on the page and their strengths, their weaknesses, opportunities, and challenges.
That's interesting. Talk about the genres in fiction that you handle.
Well, I mean, I am mostly interested in character-driven books, no matter what they are. So whether it's literary fiction or, I mean, I like an element of mystery and a romantic element also in stories, but I don't look for category mysteries and romance at all.
And Todd said that he thought he was the only thriller writer that you handled.
Right now, that is true, yes.
And was that because of his books being so character-driven? Is that what drew you in?
It was, in the beginning, yes. I mean, he could, you know, he's really interested in quirks of character that I wasn't seeing in other pages I read, and he always brought me something that I learned something new from, which is one of the benefits of this job. And he was a literary writer in the beginning, and it just happened to be that his subjects were psychological and dark, and gradually we saw a pattern that he was heading in that direction, and he became a literary crime writer.
What about nonfiction? What sort of nonfiction do you like to see come in?
I mostly like narrative nonfiction. I'm not as much interested in practical nonfiction, which are the how-to books, which are a lot driven by personality and credentials. I mean, credentials and branding are always important, but I still like the story aspect of the narrative nonfiction, whether it's science, which I love to read in my own free time, or history. If someone is a really good writer, they can take a book a subject that I thought I would never be interested in reading, and I'm captivated. And it's storytelling like that that makes me interested in a project.
What about memoir?
Yes, I like memoir. It's a lot about the writing. It's not an autobiography, and I think some people get confused with that. And it needs to be a topic that people want to read about, and a person who has a deeply personal experience, but that translates to a universal audience. So, and that is a very fine line to define. And I don't know that I can put that in words, what that is, what makes something personal and purely personal, or personal and written in a way that other people want to read about that.
So with nonfiction, then, narrative nonfiction or memoir, is that sold on the basis of a proposal these days, or do you have to write the entire book?
I think a memoir, you would have to write the entire book. A writer would have to write the entire book. And a proposal could be for another topic, but the more an idea that an editor has of what they're buying, the more writing sample there is and research that's done ahead of time, the more comfortable they feel about signing up a project and investing in the project.
Interesting. You know, something that's been talked about a lot lately, last couple of years actually, is hybrid publishing. And whenever this comes up, I always hear from listeners that say, you know, could you talk more about that? And so I'm wondering what your take is on hybrid publishing.
You know, I don't honestly have that much experience with hybrid publishing. Do you have more questions
about it?
Well,
I guess the way some publishers are working these days is that they take on projects, the ones that do hybrid publishing, they take on projects, but you don't necessarily get an advance. You might just sign on for royalties. So if they sell your book, you know, however many books they sell, they'll send you, you know, checks. And, you know, I don't know a whole lot about it either, other than that.
Well, since I'm an agent and I make my money on commission, honestly, I avoid that kind of publishing. So I admit to you that I don't have that much experience in it. I do have a couple of deals where people knew people and wanted to do something and there wasn't an advance, but that was the only non-traditional part of it, and the rest of the process was entirely traditional.
So, what you said just a few minutes ago about, agents and advances, because yes, I mean, agents make their money on the advance and on the deal. And I, you know, to me, agents are well worth their money, whatever money they get from your deal. But what about smaller presses? I mean, it used to be that agents didn't like to go to university presses or smaller presses because there wasn't enough of an advance. I mean, how do you feel about those types of publishers?
I feel like there are a lot of small publishers that are very respectable and I like working with. Even if the advance is tiny, it's, you know, what they can do. And publishing has a long history of small presses growing and growing and having successes, and it's not necessarily a straight trajectory that they go on, mm-hmm. increasing. It's, you know, they have a few years and a bunch of books that are good but don't sell very well, and then they have one and it sort of puts them on the map or something like that. And so I feel like there's a long tradition of smaller publishers, and that's not necessarily new, although there are fewer big publishers, so perhaps there is more need than ever for the smaller publishers. But that's a long tradition, and I support that fully. I mean, those are people who love books and are publishing great books that may not get published another way, and very respectable.
That's good to hear. What about writers who contact you? How do you like to hear from writers? Does it all begin with a wonderful query letter, or do you go looking? Do you look at journals and go to conferences and just, you know, also see who's out there and what they're doing?
I love to go to conferences, and I love to speak at conferences and read samples and critique them, and that's one way, although I do that. I mean, I don't expect I'm going to find a client. You never know when that's going to happen. But I also feel like I can give good information and help people in their process. In terms of official submissions, I really like to get a query letter first and 5 sample pages in an email, and that process, or that the guidelines for that are outlined on my website, dunhamlit.com. And I get a lot of them. I get a really lot of submissions, but it's always exciting to go through them and see what's come in and to find a new voice. I mean, signing up a new client is one of the most exciting parts of the job and in the business here. But I guess it is not quite as exciting as calling up and saying that you have an offer for a first book. That is thrilling.
So, okay, a query letter comes in, and you like the idea. There's something about it that's intriguing, but maybe there's a typo. Maybe your name is spelled wrong. I don't know. Do those kinds of things, even though you might like the idea, would you hit delete?
No, and I try to respond to everybody. Sometimes I get further behind in that with at least a response saying, thanks, this isn't for this agency. Not personalized necessarily, but something is better than nothing, I feel. But, yeah, I don't necessarily need everything to be perfect, and it's not just about the premise. When I'm looking, I'm trying to find, you know, an author with good credentials, a premise that's fresh. Writing in those pages should show me that I want to read more. So it's a combination of you know, what I find in the query letter that excites me.
Do you ever get query letters written in the voice of a character? If somebody is trying to get you interested in a novel and they write in that voice?
I do occasionally. I also handle some children's books, and it's more frequent that I get them, for a children's book project, you know, written in the character's voice. But honestly, I feel it's better to avoid those if possible. When someone is writing a query letter, because it's a business letter, it's not. There's no need to be cute. Just be professional. Tell me what you've got and who you are, and go from there.
There's so much info anymore on agents that writers can access on Publishers Lunch and all over the place, really. So when a writer contacts you and you start talking, what would be something that perhaps they should want to ask you that they can't find online, or would it be a matter of chemistry and just kind of the vibe, the feeling between the two of you that should influence them? I mean, you know, it used to be when you couldn't access all the stuff, ask the agent, you know, where do they have contacts? What have been recent deals? I mean, things like that. But what about these days?
Well, you're right. There is more information available online than ever before, and I think it's a big change in the industry and how it works. I would say that I think that you've sort of hit it with the chemistry angle here, and that the most important thing is, does the agent love the manuscript, really get the project, and does the agent connect well with the author, and does the author connect well with the agent in terms of communication style? You know, in the beginning, it's very exciting because the agent is interested, the author is looking for representation, that's great, but the author has to have a good enough relationship that the agent can call up and say, something bad happened, or, and here's my plan, and that the author's ears are still open and hearing what the agent is saying, because the agent is there for both the good and the bad. And editors can say things to agents that they don't feel they can say to authors directly, and agents can stand up for an author or help an author come to acceptance or find a new way, a different answer that might be feel like a win for the editor and a win for the author.
Well, that brings up something else, which is, how often might you reach out to editors with a project before you stop and regroup with the author? I mean, do you have a number that you like to hit? And you go, okay, we've sent it out 20 times and we've gotten no's. Let's think about this.
I have changed my strategy over the years on this, but in general, these days, I like to submit in small groups and get, see how that goes. And because once you have submitted to an editor, you can't submit to that editor again or anyone else at that imprint. So I like to get the feedback, and I have sold projects where we've done two or three rounds of revisions in between. Sometimes the comments come in, and it's just a way of saying, oh, that's not for me. And one should never be too invested in comments coming from a source that is not also invested in the project. But it is a personal opinion, and, it's something to consider. So I don't have a magic number, but I do feel that there has to be a good reason to submit to 20 at once to do that.
That's interesting. So, well, before we go on, let me say, for those of you who are just tuning in, that I'm with Jenny Dunham. She's a literary agent in New York. Her agency is Dunham Literary, and you can find her online. So, speaking about online, how important is it to you for a writer to have a social media platform? Will you look them up on Facebook or Twitter if you've read their query and you're going, this sounds pretty good. Who are they?
I think that's important. Yeah, who the author is, is a part of the picture and a part of what I'm going to have to pitch. And often when I pitch a project, an editor's first question is, oh, so who's the author? Who wrote this? So I need to have that in hand ahead of time. So in terms of social media, I want to make sure that someone is not doesn't have anything bad associated with them, something difficult. And I also want to see that they're building an audience of people who are following them for a reason, that they have some sort of identity and that the followers are related to that identity and branding that the author has. It doesn't have to be huge, and it doesn't have to be in every single social media outlet. It's more important to pick one and do it well and build that following than to be everywhere just a little bit and have a few followers.
Is it the same for fiction and nonfiction?
Yeah, I would say so. how they get followers and what the reason for following might be a little bit different. But, I guess the thing with fiction is nowadays there's more editors are looking for a little bit more credentials for the author related to why they're writing this type of fictional story, almost like a nonfiction credential. And, you know, I'm finding the same blending towards nonfiction that they want some almost fiction-related writing credentials from them. So I think that it's harder as a fiction writer to have that kind of following, but even to be part of a community and to know who you are as a writer and to be a part of that community online shows the ability to develop that social media platform more.
That's interesting, the sort of the crossover. And so I'm wondering, in a query letter, which I would imagine that, you know, if you take on this author, there may be elements of this query that you later use to approach an editor.
That's right.
So, like, for instance, say somebody is writing a novel about art galleries. So it would be beneficial for them to say in their query, you know, I've run an art gallery for, 10 years and blah, blah, blah. I mean, make that a part of their query.
That's right. So that might look like, well, I went to XYZ University and I studied art history and then I worked at these galleries and I, did an apprenticeship with such and such an artist or art dealer or something and I've attended these art shows and I have this social media following related to this one particular artist and I wrote this story, so all of it seems to make sense together.
Yeah. So do you think this change, because it used to be that that fiction, at least what I would hear from agents in fiction, is that, social media or your platform isn't that important. It's really important in nonfiction. But I'm wondering if it has to do anything with how it seems that it's harder to sell fiction than ever before, or is that a myth?
I think it's harder to sell books than ever before, be honest.
Sure.
And I think the industry has been through tremendous changes in the last 10 years. It is hard for a fiction writer, for sure, but these days I would say there are several important changes. There are more and more, there's more feeling that everyone online can be a critic and give a review for a book, and people feel that they have access to authors in a way that they never did. There's a proximity that someone can reach out, find an author, and expect a personal response. So it's building a more immediate relationship, whereas it used to be, there wasn't the internet where you could look up an author's private details about where they lived, and you would have to write a letter rather than send an email, which took a lot of time, and you might get a letter back and you might not. Or if you wanted to meet the person, it wasn't that you could do a Skype session, which many authors do to promote their books, but it might be that you would have to go to a book signing and stand in line and have your typical 3 seconds as the author signed the book.
So we're sort of drawing down on our time. We have a couple of minutes left, but I wanted to ask you about ageism in publishing and if you see that, or is it still really about the writing and regardless of age, if you have, if you're a good writer, you have a good story, you have a voice, you have a bit of a following or platform, or maybe not much of a platform, but you're a great writer. How does that all kind of work out?
I don't know that it's exactly ageism. Perhaps there is some of that. Publishing has always tended towards stories of the young rather than the old. But it is primarily about the writing. That piece has to be there. But platform and branding are more important than ever. So it may not be that age is the factor as I mean, for example, someone who is older and has developed a career more might have a larger following because of that investment in time and experience, and so that's better for promoting oneself.
Interesting. In closing, I wonder if you have any words of advice or anything we haven't covered that you think is really important for authors, writers who may contact you to know.
So I think really being open to anything that an agent or editor tells you, and because they're trying to improve the artistic integrity of your project, which also has to be, it's art, but it is a product as well. And I think, I think keep working at it. Most people need to write 3 to 5 full manuscripts before they hit their stride, and it gives time to figure out who you are, and that sounds like a tremendous investment, but writing is a tremendous investment, and if you work on one or two and it doesn't work, that doesn't mean you should give up. You should keep going.
Yeah, it's interesting how very many writers write one novel and it doesn't sell, and or they can't get an agent, and they go, "Well, that's it." You know, I don't
that's
have
right.
it. You know, I should move on to something else.
I think we hear about that more. You know, I wrote one and it sold. You know, I found an agent and it sold because it is more remarkable and unusual.
Yeah, it sure is. Jenny Dunham, thank you so much for coming on the show. I really, really appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for inviting me. I've really enjoyed it, and I'm sure that Todd, who is in the listening background, will hear about it later, too.
Thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
That was Jenny Dunham. She, again, is a literary agent in New York, Dunham Literary, easy to find. Hopefully you have listened to this entire show, and if you plan to query her, you have lots of tidbits, lots of good stuff to go on. If you tuned in late, I'll be podcasting this show probably within a few days at penonfire.com. And again, you can go to iTunes and subscribe to Writers on Writing, and when it is podcast, you will receive it. But that's all we have for you today. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. You've been listening to Writers on Writing. Thank you so much for staying with us. And if you're a writer, remember to stay in the chair.